Good morning, everyone. The Senate Interim Committee on Education and Workforce Development is open. We have quite a few things on the agenda today and some very meaningful concepts that we're going to see in legislation in the next few months from now. I want to start off by talking about a man who is a Holocaust survivor up in Washington County. He had hoped to be here today to talk about some of the strong feelings he has on Holocaust education in Oregon schools, and we couldn't get the logistics together to get him to come down here, but he has spoken to school kids in the past. His testimony, however, is on OLA, so it's in the record. I will read one sentence from it. When I was liberated on May 9th, 1945, I weighed 80 pounds, just skin and bones, a skeleton. He has told his story to school kids around Oregon that, in their words, have prevented suicides, inspired them to go on to college, and inspired them to be better individuals. So I hope that there's a place down the road where we can get him down here, and if nothing else, I hope that people can access this testimony and read more about Alton Weiner.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest we try to get him here when we're actually in session, and maybe he would inspire this committee. Just a thought.
So, we're going to take a look at the report on the volatility and viability of tuition-free community colleges in Oregon. Dennis Jones is here, and Ben Cannon, if you could both come up here. I should say a word about both of these gentlemen because it's an interesting confluence to have them here at the same desk today. Dennis Jones and some of his colleagues at the National Center for Higher Education were instrumental in some of the restructuring we've been doing over the last 4 years, particularly in Senate Bill 242 in the 2011 session, which created a sea change in our public university system. And the people who were on the task force that came up with the concept that turned into legislation, that turned into law, were not so brilliant to do that on their own. Never would have probably gotten there with on their own devices, but we were helped mightily by Dennis Jones, who not only said you should turn your public universities from state agencies into public universities, which we did, changing their legal status. He also said the best practices in this country create some sort of a coordination function, a coordination commission that you should have accompanying this concept. And so that's what we did. We created in 2011 the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And it is now law. It is now a fully functioning agency, if you will, and sort of the grandfather, godfather of that is Dennis Jones here. And what you have born is the director, Ben Cannon, a Rhodes Scholar of that commission. So it's sort of like this has all come to fore thanks to, in part, your recommendations, Mr. Jones. So it's a delight to have you here in Oregon. And we've been looking forward to your presentation from you and Director Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I'll turn it over to Dennis, who will deliver the meat of this presentation in a moment. As you know, Senate Bill 1524 that you passed earlier this year charged the commission, the HEC, with studying the viability of a program that would allow a student who graduated from high school in Oregon or completed grade 12 through homeschooling to attend community college without paying tuition and fees for a specified period of time. To complete our study and help us with recommendations to you about the viability of this idea, we contracted, the HEC contracted with the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, or NCHEMS, and I'm pleased that Dennis Jones, their executive director, is here today to share some of their initial work, primarily around costing out different versions of free community college. The HEC received the report that you'll see today last week. We will be submitting this report to you not only today, but in writing later this month. We will follow that up next month with recommendations from the commission. So what you'll hear today is largely informational. It's the costing work that NCHMS has done. The commission will be weighing in with its thoughts after we've had the opportunity to fully deliberate, and we'll send that in follow up. I do want to just suggest some of the kinds of questions that the HEC will be attempting to answer as we review Dennis's work. We'll be interested in questions such as which of the scenarios that Dennis describes today, which versions of Free Community College would target students who have been traditionally underrepresented in post-secondary education? Which are scenarios that maximize the state's investment? Is our preferred strategy for community college to be free or fully affordable? They're different questions. Or put another way, what's the best strategy to get more students into and through a two-year certificate or degree program? We'll be attempting to ascertain whether these scenarios benefit students at different income levels or whether they generally are focused on students within a particular income range. We want to understand sort of the distributional effects of the various scenarios that Dennis will describe today. We will be interested, at least in attempting to answer, whether there's a way to build a program of free community college that would remove the requirement for students to complete a FAFSA. Can we take that barrier away? What you'll hear from Dennis today is built around the existing financial aid system, which makes a lot of sense, but it maintains the FAFSA barrier that some students experience today. We'll be attempting to understand how this concept might fit with our recommendation to target new Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars towards the first 2 years of attendance. We'll be asking what the potential adverse consequences for four-year universities may be of going down this path. And we'll be asking whether there are additional costs associated with this type of proposal that may not be captured here, including capacity issues for community colleges and any sort of messaging work that would need to be done in conjunction with Free Community College in order to realize its promise. So we're very excited in the work, very appreciative of the legislature teeing this up for us, and look forward to having a full set of recommendations to share with you between now and the legislative session. In the meantime, look forward to sharing with you the work that NCHMS has done.
Okay. Thanks, Ben. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dennis Jones. I'm president of the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, better known to the world as NCHMS. And the work that we've done for the Coordinating Commission in Oregon is to create a variety of scenarios that say at the lowest end the cost would be this, at the highest end it would be this, and there's lots of variations in between. And the variations take kind of two forms. One, it is the filter that says who can participate in such a program. And that is it recent high school graduates only, or is it all students starting in community college? So is it those that graduated within the last year, or is it all community college students? Do they have to be full-time, or can it be part-time as well? So those give you lots of variations to take a look at. It's the question of, and we've built different scenarios assuming different levels of participation, starting with status quo and going to a very high level of participation, high being the rate at which students from the county in the state with the highest college participation go, and assuming that students from all counties go at that rate. And what that really does is create a huge demand in Multnomah County, for example. Okay, I mean, it raises large numbers of students being brought into the system under that scenario. Unrealistically high, quite frankly, but it puts the upper bounds on what it might look like. And the third variation in this is are students eligible for 2 years or 3 years? And one of the things you'll see, it doesn't make much difference on that one. The cost doesn't change much if they're given a third year to finish up a program. Okay?
Okay.
That it can assume the first or last dollar in, we have here both tuition only and cost of attendance as the base. And on the cost of attendance calculations, we use shared responsibility, which is the calculation that's used to calculate the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as the basis for the calculation.
And so, can I get you to, I'm not sure everybody is familiar with the last dollar in phraseology. Can
okay.
you give us a quick explanation
yeah,
of that?
And the last dollar in would be something that says, here's the, you know, in this case, it only applies to full cost of attendance, okay? It says that here's the cost. Students themselves are expected to put in about $6,000 from their own work, so 15 hours of work a week during the school year. Summer work at minimum wage in the state generates a number around $6,000. So it's the students are expected to be the first contributor to their own cost. Then parents contribute in the federal expected family contribution amount. Pell and tuition tax credits kick in. Opportunity grant, Oregon Opportunity Grants factor in at the maximum of $2,000 for a full-time student, $1,000 for a part-time student. And in the model, it calculates that only 20% of the eligible community college students get those grants, because that's the current reality. Of the eligible students, are students eligible for opportunity grant, 20% of them actually get it. The program is not nearly rich enough to fund all the eligible students. The process is one that expends the money on a first-come, first-served basis. Community college students tend to be last-come, last-served. They almost always, all states, have the problem of community college students applying for aid much later than their four-year university counterparts. So the free tuition covers anything that's left. That's the way the calculation works. Okay? That's the last dollar in.
Okay?
Okay. And this is just, I'm not going to go over it again. This just says there's a set of filters that you can change. And what we've built for the Coordinating Commission is a model that lets them play with a lot of levers and say, if this, then that. And lots of things can change. You can change participation rates. You can change assumptions about income characteristics of the students that will come into the program. You can change lots of things. And this is just the restatement of the cost of attendance that I just went through. Okay? The point is, this is a heuristic model, not a predictive model. Okay, this says, under this set of assumptions, this is what will happen. This is the cost of the program. Rather than something that says, we will predict that exactly this many students will participate and et cetera. Because part of the problem in trying to do anything predictive is the lack of data about certain really important pieces of this. I mean, they're unknowable in Oregon at the moment. And the biggest one is around, what are the economic characteristics of students who will come into who will be added under any kind of a new aid program. So what we have assumed is that all new students will have the same income distribution as current students who file a FAFSA. And for community colleges, that means that fully two-thirds are in the lowest income quartile, and fully half are in the bottom two. So 80% of the community college students are students that have incomes of about $48,000 or less, family incomes. That the projected additional students, and we on the conservative estimate, I've said business as usual, same number as now. Nothing changes. Aggressive estimates is that all counties have highest participation of the county at the top. We are building a third version of this that says in between here is a version that closes half of the gap between where counties are and what the highest participation would be. So it puts it somewhere in the middle. And 20% of community college students will either get a $2,000 grant if they're full-time or a $1,000 grant if they're part-time, and that's the current number. That model, that number and assumption can be changed in the model. Okay, so it lets the commission say, we can change that to, let's say, 40% or whatever, then what happens? Okay, because opportunity grant money, free community college money are, in many ways, direct offsets. If they get an opportunity grant, they don't need the free community college. If you use the assumption of cost of attendance, not just tuition. Okay? So we've got here four different kinds of scenarios, and within each are variations on the theme. This one is directly out of high school only, so you have to graduate within the last year. Tuition and fees only, it's not cost of attendance. And Pell dollars are the first dollar in. Okay, so any eligibility of a student, if they get Pell money, is reduced by the amount of the Pell grant. Okay? And then within that, there's conservative and aggressive. Two-year and three-year estimates, and that's the one that shows there's not a lot of difference. The number of students on the right is the number of students who fit that filter. So they're the full-time students directly out of high school. Okay? And there's 7,300 of them under the conservative estimate.
And these are annual
costs. And these are annual costs, okay?
Oh,
okay. Annual costs. Sorry. And, you know, so about $9 million is the low-end estimate of all of this under that scenario. The point that I want to make is that all of that will go to students in the upper 20% of the income profile because the Pell offsets the money for the low-income students. So under the first dollar in, with as Pell as the first dollar in, covers tuition for, Pell is bigger than your tuition. So if you get a Pell grant, tuition's covered.
And you're saying that a program like this wouldn't help those kids anymore, but they're already being helped. It tends to help more of the middle-class families.
This is a middle-class program.
Which is not...
not necessarily bad. It's just...
it's certainly not bad.
But it's also, you know, but again, it's also something that says students have to pay cost of attendance, not just tuition. And cost of attendance is about four times what tuition is. I mean, tuition is the small part of a student's costs because room and board, books, transportation, all the rest of those things are the costly parts. And the thing we have to remember, particularly for more so for low-income students, even if they live at home, they are expected to contribute to family income, so it's not free to them. And as a consequence, if they can't somehow cover the cost of living, then the tuition, free tuition, may not matter, okay, because the other costs swamp the costs of tuition for them.
But that's the case now.
That's the case now.
Yeah.
Okay. Aggressive, bigger assumptions, more students. At the bottom is not just full-time, but it's full-time plus part-time. And about a third of the students that come to community colleges right out of high school are part-time students, two-thirds of full-time. So different mixes, full-time plus part-time at the bottom here. If you do both of those aggressively, it's about a $20 million problem or project, okay? This one says tuition only, Pell Funds first dollar in, but we're taking not only recent high school graduates, but all eligible community college participants, adults and recent high school graduates. And you see that the numbers for on the conservative side for full-time and adult students going to community colleges, a little bit less than a third of them are full-time. More than two-thirds are part-time. So it's just the reverse of recent high school graduates. The big numbers of adults are part-time students. And so you see very large numbers at the bottom under the aggressive side, and that's because large numbers of assumed part-time participants. It balloons the size of the program from 20 million or thereabouts to, you know, from, yeah, 20 million to 73 million, 74 million. Large, and that's the assumption of large pickup of part-time students. Okay? And then there are two scenarios here that are based on cost of attendance rather than tuition only, where the free community college dollar would be the last dollar in after student work, family, Pell, OOG. This is what's left. And under those conditions, recent high school graduates, just full-time, it becomes a under the aggressive, $29 million. And so, you know, I mean, it's not the difference between full between tuition and cost of attendance for recent high school graduates is not huge. It's when you open the program to lots of adults that and pay their cost of attendance after everything else is taken into consideration, that the program gets very large. So, you know, the questions before the commission and before you are as much as anything, who should be eligible for this? Is it just full-time students, regardless of age, and recent high school graduates? Is it just recent high school graduates? Is it full-time only? I mean, those are the levers that control cost. The cost of the program itself is determined almost solely by who's eligible. Okay? So, and therefore, I think the question before the House is, how do you target funds to be the most helpful to getting to 40-40-20, to getting some help for students who most need it? And that's the thing that this is allows investigation of some of that. There's no good answer to that one. Okay?
Thank you for the study and this data, and does give us a chew. And I think you're exactly right that we have to find the best combination of those to do the get the biggest bang for our buck. I don't think anybody in the legislature right now thinks that we can afford our ambitions to provide, you know, room and board for everybody, and we're not there yet, but this is definitely a very helpful document. Any questions?
All of these are annual, right, Costa?
All of these are annual.
Thank you.
Mr. Cannon, do
Well, I think you, the committee's received a good sense of the types of issues that the commission will be wrestling with over the next month or so in preparation of its recommendations to you. Any sort of advice or guidance that you have, we certainly welcome either now or in follow-up. We're interested in providing recommendations to you that are useful. That's part of the reason for the costing out. It probably isn't very useful for you to receive a recommendation from us to spend $500 million of additional funding that is unlikely to exist within this budget. But we do want to give you some options that are potentially at least plausible and fundable, and that's a big part of our interest in Dennis's work.
Mr. Jones, you look at what all states are doing in this area. Are we going down the right road here?
Well, any money that puts, or any program that puts money in the hands of needy students is well worth it. So, you know, any of those is a right path. I think the real question, and now it gets into the values. What's the highest priority? But I think that if you take a look at 40-40-20 as a goal, we've been looking at the number since very early on in that conversation. It's the middle 40 that is the big gap in this state. And within that, it is largely around high-value certificates. That is the place where there is the biggest opportunity to make progress and to serve the workforce needs and to serve adults. And you put those three things together. My observation would be that anything that puts money in the hands of adults that helps them get short-term certificates that are workplace-oriented is a very good investment. And so how one targets some of this is probably the main feature. And I talked to Senator Haas just before the meeting a little bit. And I just suggest that you look at a program that Tennessee has called Wilder NAFI. But it's for the former Speaker of the House and another legislator. And it's specifically targeted to that audience, and it is free tuition with no strings attached, no FAFSA, no nothing, but it's very heavily targeted toward a particular type of student. It's not everybody's eligible. And so, I mean, that's another way to come at something like this.
I was struck by a conversation we had that you said Oregon is, because of its dependency on lumber mills and that world being gone, similar to Iowa and Ohio that lost the auto
industry.
And there's some parallels there.
Yep.
And the need for community college or opportunities.
Yep. When we took a look at the highest demand workforce in the state, through your own Department of Labor statistics and et cetera, interestingly, the one job that's in greatest demand for which they aren't applicants is commercial truck drivers. Okay, it's folks with a CDL.
I have a CDL, so I'm fine.
but it's one of those kinds of programs I'm talking about that's got high value. That you can get it in not too many months.
Senator Roblin.
As a high school principal, we tried to develop a program so that we could get seniors, actually juniors and seniors, to get into our community college, and our school district would pay tuition and make that work. When we started out, we paid the tuition, and they went off, and we found a sad rate of students who signed up, went for a few days, and didn't finish, and we paid tuition and didn't receive any benefit. So then we went to UGO. You take the course, we'll help you do that. Once you've completed the class and have a passing grade, we'll pay the tuition. That limited our poor kids because they didn't have the upfront cash. So trying to figure out that balance was very difficult. Any thoughts on that? With the adult population, it's not nearly as bad. Those people are committed. They want to go back, and the help they get, they generally tend to use. But for those first early, just graduate students, it's much more difficult to predict who will use that money properly.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, that same cash flow problem, not having the money up front, is the biggest reason why employers' tuition assistance programs aren't used nearly to the level that they might be. I mean, many of the major employers have free tuition programs for their adult, you know, for the adults, for employees. They don't pick up on them, and it's not because of the cost. It's because they say, you pay the cost, you get a passing grade, and we'll reimburse you. It's a cash flow problem, not an overall funding problem. But, you know, I mean, some of the things that some states have done is basically put the money out there on a either a monthly or twice a semester basis that says you don't get it all up front, you get some. And if you are still enrolled at the next point, you get the next payment, and et cetera. So it spreads the cash flow problem out. I mean, that's one solution to what you're up against.
Yep. If I, just quickly on that point, because I think it's a really important one, a couple of the other possibilities that have been adopted in other states include requiring some element of guidance or mentorship for students who are participating in this program. So Tennessee, which is doing sort of a scenario one that Dennis described here, something very similar under their Tennessee Promise, has makes this pledge to students of free community college, but imposes some requirements, including establishing a relationship with a community-based counselor, mentor, essentially. Indiana has a different type of program. It's not community college specific, but it also provides greater access using state dollars, but imposes the expectation that they're using coaching and they receive those services with additional costs to the funders, but with additional supports for students to try to deal with the very issue you described.
Is that a rule?
Yeah, and one other option that I think exists that some of our high schools are doing in their programs that send kids to community colleges, weekly or monthly checks where the professor sends a deal saying they're progressing appropriately, and they said that has increased their kids' success rate dramatically because they know someone's checking to see that they're actually, even though they paid up front.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Ben, when did you say we were going to be able to have this report?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we will be submitting an interim report, which will be based on what the data you've seen today.
Right.
We'll submit that this month.
Okay.
We will submit, likely in October, after our next full commission meeting, recommendations from the commission. So not just the data, but also some sense of our commission's recommendations to you about how to proceed legislatively.
Okay. I would, Mr. Chair, I would hope that we're talking about hard copies for those of us who are electronically challenged.
We will be happy to ensure that you receive a hard copy, Senator Cruz.
And we're getting legislation drafted to sort of correlate with some of those recommendations, and we should have that in December.
Absolutely.
So, thanks again, Dennis, for coming out here.
Always good to see you. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. These two subjects are sort of joined at the hip. Hilda Roselli, College and Career Readiness Director, are you here, Hilda? She's going to talk about the Accelerated Learning Committee update, which is essentially getting more high school students in Oregon earning more college credits and how we can do that in a more uniform way in the state. Hilda, thanks for joining us today. Where are we on that work?
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli. I serve as the Director for College and Career Readiness for the Oregon Education Investment Board, and as such, supported Chair Nancy Golden in the work of this committee this year. As a refresher, I wanted to just review what the charge of the committee was and to remind you all that there is also another report that will be coming to the legislatures on October 1st. 2014, where I have a draft almost ready for the committee to weigh in on and provide edits, so we're on time with that as well.
You all have a copy of the draft.
Pardon?
They all have copies of this draft.
Actually, the draft of the legislative report, the full legislative report, should be going to you all for your edits and then finalizing that at our September 30th meeting. So what I did provide to you was a document that was helpful, was requested by the Oregon Education Investment Board, and was found to be helpful, that kind of highlighted some of the research summary. So that's a hard copy and has been submitted to you all. As a review, also, the committee members were appointed and have been meeting. In fact, we've met 7 times. I corrected that and went back and checked. 7 times that they've met. They've established a goal and parameters that have guided their work. They've looked at a variety of research results. They've analyzed other states' policies. They consulted with stakeholders. They brought in policy leaders from other states to meet with them. They used the equity lens to help think about the recommendations that they were putting forward. We used a draft concept paper that was issued in May that sort of shaped some thinking around, okay, what do we want to include as recommendations, and then use that to move forward with examining some of the implications for those recommendations, as well as the costs for those. And that has also been something that has been vetted quite substantially with a number of different associations, groups that you would think of that are certainly stakeholders in this work. And then lastly, they began looking at a legislative concept that is in draft formation, LC 274, and they will be continuing to work on that. They also are going to have to make a decision. Their charge may be completed by October 1st, so I assume that the next meeting will make some decisions on whether or not the group will continue to formally meet. I wanted to just draw out attention to the guiding parameters that have been used throughout this year's work around equity, around student-centric policy. And this, I just want to explain, this is starting to appear a lot in conversations around policy, where we're starting to look at how we are blurring more of those lines between a student finishing out K-12 and moving on to that next sector of education. Much as Senator Roblin was talking about, we have evidence that the more we can help students smooth those paths, the more likely they are to continue on. A very key point was around transferability, and we've defined that and actually think we have some better language for that that will really hone in on what we mean by that in terms of making sure that students are not penalized for the courses they take while they're still in high school, and that they are indeed transferable to things like the Oregon Transfer Module and to programs that may have recognized career technical certificates. We spent considerable time this year on high school instructor qualifications, and I'll outline where we are on that as we move forward. Just as a refresher for you and for those in the audience, we have talked extensively about what kinds of programs are included in this work, certainly dual credit, expanded options. We have talked about our fifth year programs and recognized that there actually may be some additional kinds of actions that may be needed to address fifth year programs. We believe that they have some good intentions. They have some unintended consequences. We fixed one of those through Rob Saxton's work around reporting more accurately high school graduation rates. But there are still some issues around budgets that must be addressed. And, of course, career technical education. We also spent considerable time thinking about advanced placement and international baccalaureate. And I really heard repeatedly from all of the committee members that there's a tremendous support for that work, but a recognition that there are some different mechanisms that really define differently what the needs are to expand those programs. For example, an IB curriculum does not require collaboration between the high schools and the post-secondary institutions to approve the curriculum. It's already a standardized curriculum. The exams are developed at a different level. They're scored at a different level. The instructors are trained at a different level. So a lot of this work that's in the legislative concept deals primarily with what do we need to support in order to get a sustained collaboration for the other kinds of accelerated learning options. options. I will note that one of the high key priorities for those who are interested in the continued access for AP and IB is around the rising costs of textbooks and some of the costs of those courses and how those costs are covered. In addition, I mentioned earlier that you have a full research summary, but I just pulled out a couple of the benefits that are so particularly clear both nationally, and they hold out when we look at our own data here in Oregon. And Bob Kiern, who has been with the Oregon University System, is in the process of completing a third round of his own study, not his own, but the state study, on dual credit outcomes. And as soon as that becomes available, we'll certainly share that as well. Lingering issues. This very first one, I want to spend a moment on this because it's actually tied to two lingering issues. One is around the equity of access across the state. And with that came real recognition, at least on my part as a staff person, around another lingering issue, and that is the very last one, the documentation of impact towards 40-40-20 goal. We lack right now in our state a comprehensive one way of looking at the impact and numbers and who's in these programs and what are they earning. It is monitored and documented in different ways by different systems. It's very difficult to find all of this in one place. In fact, it doesn't exist yet. And so I've done a lot of hand calculations, and I'm just going to tell you roughly, if we think about the fact there's 18 international baccalaureate programs in the state, and pretty much we know where those are. Then you start to think about the records of what we have on students taking dual credits in our state. And working with Education Northwest and using data from the Oregon Department of Education, we were able to identify that there are probably 200 roughly high schools that may include public high school charter schools, and even some other like K-12 schools in our smaller rural areas that right now, at least from our most current data, which is 11-12, are offering fewer than three dual credit courses for students in their schools. In addition to that, about two dozen schools showed that we had absolutely no students taking any dual credit courses. So those are the equity gaps that we're really trying to address here. Secondly, there's been a lot of discussion, and it's certainly supported by the research, that students who see themselves as college ready and on a college track may already be taking very progressive steps with support from their families to move forward on a great path towards post-secondary ed. What we're more concerned about is students who don't see themselves as college ready, who may benefit from trying out a college course that gives them a sense of what is college rigor expecting of me, and am I prepared for that. The research is also clear that if we can support those trial courses with some support services, much like Ben Cannon referenced and Senator Roblin referenced earlier, that students are more likely to see themselves as college going. Another lingering issue was the equitable funding. We know that there are great partnerships in the state that have worked out arrangements, but our concern is that some of those may not be sustainable given the funding that we have available. And so if a college and a high school negotiate, well, we'll do something for $10 a credit, the question is whether or not that's going to be sustainable over the long term, and does it cover all of the additional costs that really need to be in place. For example, there has to be collaboration to assure college rigor in those classes. There's a process that should be followed in providing support for the instructors, whether they be high school qualified instructors. There needs to be transcripting, there needs to be advising, and there certainly needs to be ongoing checkpoints around the alignment between the curriculum. We've already mentioned transferability, college credits that mean something, and I've referenced these other two. Oh, wrong button. So let's briefly look at what those areas of recommendations are in the report as well as in the legislative concept. One is that there is an intention to give every student opportunity to have access, free access, to equivalent of 3 college courses, might be the equivalent of 9 college credits. We're sort of using that language of 3 college courses because that lines up with achievement compacts and people are familiar with that. But it also says that students need to experience those courses, figure out their level of college and career readiness, and have some supports to help them as they move forward. In terms of program development, a high priority around those courses that are going to transfer into core subject areas, and also the need that may exist to seed partnerships in some of those schools that I mentioned have nothing at all offered for students. In addition, that certainly means that we could make sure that our existing AP and IB programs have filled seats in all of their classes as well. In terms of financial provisions, I've already mentioned the desire to keep the cost at nothing for students in terms of their tuition, textbooks, and program fees. And we spent a lot of time looking at the fact that some people may say, well, are we double funding this? And the truth is, in some ways you are. You're paying for FTE, which is under a budgeted model in both the community college as in the four-year institutions, in a very different way that's budgeted from how you're funding students through an ADM that is then saying, okay, part of that money needs to go towards the cost of getting students that tuition. We feel strongly as a whole group, at least the committee does, that there has to be attention to those additional costs. Faculty time to visit those schools, to be with those faculty if they are not teaching the courses themselves, instructor record models, and the like. So what was suggested was a floor and ceiling. We looked at recent legislation passed in Ohio that is using something similar, and looking at a per credit charge that the partnerships could negotiate. There was even a suggestion of a default. We did look at some potential areas around incentive funding, including an idea that didn't gain traction around maybe giving some incentive to the student that once they earn a college credit that they could maybe get some funding held for them in OSAC that they could apply later for an opportunity grant. But also even some incentive funding that may take place as the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission moves towards performance funding for community colleges and the like, and also for perhaps looking at incentives for K-12 systems that are increasing the number of those students in the opportunity gap that are not taking advantage or getting into these classes now. In terms of facilities and faculty, the primary areas here were discussed around inequities that appear to be perceived around instructor qualifications. And I'll give you one example that was brought to us by one of the members of the committee, and that is that if you have an international baccalaureate teacher that's been qualified to teach maybe the most advanced course in an IB curriculum, and that person may or may not have earned a master's in the content area, and yet that person may have a strong track record of scoring of her students, his or her students scoring a 5 on a externally validated and scored international baccalaureate exam, and yet because that person may not have a master's degree, they may be seen as less viable as an approved instructor for even a dual credit course that might be moving a student up on the next level of math. So I've met along with Chair Golden and Ben Cannon and Rob Saxton with members of the OEA and AFT faculty unions to look at some potential areas that we could reach agreement on, including perhaps an equivalency chart that might say, okay, here's a gold standard that everybody feels good about. Are there some other equivalencies that people could embrace that would then also help with that issue of shortages for high school instructors? Also with that came a recommendation that did go to the Outcomes and Investments Subcommittee around seed funding that could be put into place to put together summer online courses that would give high school instructors more access, predictable access, to content, graduate content in graduate coursework in their content area, which is what many of them may be lacking. In terms of quality assurances, these are all still those aspects that have to go along with access. The rigor of the courses, making sure that they truly are comparable with college coursework, and then also making sure that the college-going culture is accompanying this effort. We've talked about the fact that you could offer access to courses, much like was talked about earlier. If you don't have the complementary skill supports for students and somewhat intrusive advising to help them move forward through volunteers, mentors, counselors, and teachers, that they may not be able to take full advantage of those systems. Lastly, we talked about transferability and transparency and the fact that we have in place an individual career and academic plan required for students for their diploma and high school graduation that may or may not be fully maximized yet. Maybe that's a way to help get that transparency going for students and their families and getting more information to them. And then also this very fact that you don't have a clear mechanism for monitoring where you're making progress, where are students in the opportunity gap increasing their participation or not, and the need for some sort of a biannual report that would really track this and give you the answers to questions. So in review, these are the recommendations intent, and you will be receiving a copy of the full report after the next Accelerated Learning Committee meeting, which is September 30th, which is like the day before the report is due. So I'll be glad to take any questions that you may have at this time.
Thank you.
And I certainly look to Senator Haas, who's been, you know, very providing leadership throughout this process.
Thanks for that. That update, I think the gist of this was in one of your bullets that said when a kid earns college credits in high school, especially those from lower socioeconomic families, they are statistically much more likely to complete college degree. So that's really what this is all about. So questions of Hilda?
And I might add that it's complete high school, and the data that has been tracked by many people is complete a degree at post-secondary. It's like a really double win.
Senator Roper.
Yeah. Have we been trying to figure out how to track how many credits our kids are now earning?
Yes.
I would think with our identifier for students, if we could figure out how to get identifiers for college credit, it would really be helpful so that we'd know how many college credits we are actually having students receive at this particular time, including AP and IB.
Chair Haas and Senator Roblin, you are absolutely correct on that. And the data exist. What doesn't exist is there isn't one way that they're measured in the same way in one report. So what you have is we have AP, we have IB, that one's harder to track sometimes, and then you have dual credit, and then you have people in early college programs, and there isn't one report that's pulling all that together. I think that's part of the intention of something like a longitudinal data system, to begin to say, let's pull the data from separate places so that you can answer those kinds of questions with one report, with one way of looking at students.
Follow up.
Have we continued a conversation with higher ed at the community college and at the university level about consistency with regard to scores on AP tests and efficiencies in IB? Because my kids from our high school could get more credits from a private institution like Yale or Harvard than they could from the University of Oregon, and none from their community college. So, I mean, it was kind of like, what are we saying to these kids that we're saying, go find a private school if you want to use your credits, as opposed to using those credits in an institution here in the state? It was always surprising to me. And
sure.
I have personal experience with what my kids got when they went to University of Oregon and when they went to USC. Totally different expectations for the same kinds of scores.
Chair Haas and Senator Roblin, it's a very good point, and there's also a flip of that, that you would find that dual credit courses may be accepted at community colleges and four-year institutions, but perhaps not at Reed.
Absolutely.
So I would say that this group, this committee, has not taken that on as a particular focus around the AP and IB, but I know that that has been an ongoing charge that the at least the Oregon University system was looking at, and I certainly will pass that on, and I don't see Ben Cannon here, but I'm sure he's listening, and that will probably be continued focus. I think we have consistency issues across the board, consistency around placement tests, consistency around what's accepted, and I think this is probably going to be the year that we have to dig into that work much more deeply.
Yeah. My final one, I tend to believe that if you want a culture that encourages kids to go on to higher education, then having your own program in your schools is really helpful, whether it's AP or IB, along with dual credit. I like dual credit as well. I mean, I think they have different niches for different people. But when you have your own faculty in your school, whether it's in a small school or whatever, who are talking about curriculum that is college-based, it changes the conversation in the school for your kids and others. And really what we talk about, I believe, if you want kids to go on, is having a culture in those schools that gives them a belief that because I have taken these courses, because I have worked in this school and done these things, the expectation is I will be successful when I go on. If you have a school that doesn't have that culture and you send kids to individual courses in dual credit, I do not believe is as successful as those kids that go there already believing that I am being prepared for that. And I think there is a part about culture in schools that plays into this whole thing, and we don't check it very often. We don't test it. But, you know, I look at the Newports and the Oregon that's had IB for a long time. I look at the courses, the groups that have a number of AP classes, and you watch those kids, even the kids that come from lower socioeconomic, getting into that drift because their other friends are. And I don't know how to quantify that, but I hope that we keep having an ongoing conversation that all of these opportunities are really important. And I'm happy you talked about AP and IB because I think it's a really important part of the whole mix. I love community colleges. We used our community colleges as often as we could, but and universities, if you're close enough to one where you can get your kids there. But but every school, and we did some stuff, you know, 10 or 15 years ago by getting instructions to teachers to get them to take more AP courses and put them in these smaller schools. And I just think it raises everybody. And I agree with you, the other big problem is trying to figure out how to get the acceptance of that teacher who teaches exceptionally well and knows the subject matter to get that person to calculus, for example, but doesn't have that degree in math that makes it difficult. It should be based, if we're really looking at proficiencies, it should be based on what the student can do. And if they can come out and take the tests, they should be able to get credit for it. So,
well, Chair Haas and Senator Roblin, I just would add one comment to that observation about a shared culture. I like to think of it as a shared responsibility from
both
the providers, if it's an external provider or a partner. But what we're seeing is that the dialogues that high school instructors have, whether it be around AP or having a conversation with a college, community college partner around the rigor of a course, both partners are benefiting from it. The high school understands better what's expected at the college. The college is also learning about strategies that high school teachers are using to address the needs of students, because that sometimes has not been of their preparation.
One final comment. Sure. I absolutely agree with that. And I know, and to encourage your teachers who are engaged in AP courses to put their name in to go become a grader and go to those other deals, those are some of the best things that our teachers ever did, because off to Florida I go to grade AP English exams, and all of a sudden I'm sitting with a whole bunch of other teachers who are doing the same thing, and the university kind of level people telling them what the expectations are. They come back with a much better knowledge of the subject and how to go about teaching it because of the interactions, and it does exactly what you're saying. So I would encourage anybody that has those to encourage their teachers to try to get to that next level of being a participant in the grading and so on.
Senator Roblin, I'd be incomplete in not sharing also that Eastern Promise is doing that on a large scale,
absolutely,
where the faculty and the high school instructors score the students' work together and have some very dynamic conversations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you want to take a break or just plow through? We're going to keep plowing through here and go till 11 o'clock and move into the Common Core and assessments. We have a panel led by Dr. Colleen Milham, who I believe is here, and her team.
So, Mr. Chair, we have a representative because we haven't come up.
Oh, I'm sorry. A representative, Frederick?
Yep.
Did you want to weigh in?
No, just want to sit up here with us.
Yes, okay. Yes, by all means. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colleen Milam, and I'm in the Center for Great Public Schools at the Oregon Education Association. And just a bit of context, that center is emerging as a place for teachers to come to support their practice, to seek assistance around their practice, but also to bring voice, teacher voice, to policy discussions and informing policy discussions. So that lays the groundwork for today's discussion around teacher voice, around Common Core. I also want to introduce Jenna Miller, who is a teacher at Happy Valley Middle School in the North Clackamas School District. And Jenna's going to share her perspective around the work with Common Core and the assessment aspect of that work. One of the things that I would mention as we move through these slides is as we think about teacher voice around the Common Core and the assessments, I think you're going to see that teachers are really focused on that center part, that practice part. We've spent a lot of time over the years talking about standards, what should the standards be for our K-12 students as well as even higher ed, and we've talked a lot about assessment. It is now the focus around that practice piece. What kinds of resources do we really encourage around that practice piece in supporting teachers? So I'm going to share some statistics with you so you can kind of see the pattern of what has transpired in terms of educator or teacher voice around the Common Core. The National Education Association did a poll in September of 2013. At that point in time, more than 75% of NEA members either supported the Common Core state standards wholeheartedly or with reservations. However, few were optimistic that they were going to get the kinds of supports that they needed to implement these standards as they began to delve into the standards, as well as the whole issue of professional development. Only 1 in 4 teachers said that they were playing a major role in the implementation of the standards. So that's that part of teacher voice. Let's jump ahead a little bit see if I can get this to work correctly, to this spring. The National Education Association did another poll in the early part of the year of 2014. And they did online focus groups, and Oregon, the Oregon Education Association was part of that effort. They did online focus groups, and then they did a web survey of 334 teacher members. In addition, they worked with other states as well, so you can see that data on the screen. So as we look at the data, majority support Common Core, but most have some reservations. So notice that the support has declined somewhat because we're now getting into much more of the implementation and the need for ongoing support for that implementation. They support the core because of emphasis on the critical thinking and decision-making opportunities in terms of their students and the students' education. They help students develop the critical thinking and problem-solving skills. So those are several things that they really look towards in a positive way around the Common Core. Clearer guidelines and goals. But let's consider what they think about that they're not supportive of. The very first part is too much emphasis on standardized tests. Secondly, and this is what
Excuse
we hear.
Me, are you, yes. Your figures here from the survey of national?
No, this is Oregon.
Oregon.
This is Oregon. Thank you for that question, Ms. Mr. Chair. So another aspect is their concern around developmentally appropriate of the standards as they're beginning to implement and looking at the diversity of students in their classroom. As you look down the list, you can see not enough resources that in terms of their percentage of feeling like they're not supportive of, that's declining as you look down that list. When we think about the concerns that they have, notice that 87% have concerns around state and federal. The federal government have rushed into the implementation of the Common Core, as well as the Common Core siphons more of the time and money for assessments that schools could use for other things. And I would focus that those other things on the notion of practice and focusing on classroom practice and assessments that inform inform learning. Also, as you look down that list, again, developmentally appropriate is, again, identified. And note the differences in color in terms of the percentage that are very concerned versus overall concerned. Half of the respondents believe implementation of the Common Core standards in their district is going in the wrong direction. As you look at this slide, 10 means that it's going in the right direction, and 0 means it's going in the wrong direction. And again, I want to just mention the whole notion of teacher voice and teacher involvement in looking at the implementation is really influencing the reaction. Have you had the opportunity to help inform your school or district plan for the Common Core implementation? Teachers are not given enough input, and very few say they are being heard. This particular slide is very, very informative and helpful because it starts to get at some of the details. There are disconnects between what teachers really need and what they're getting. And I think we hear that often as we're interacting with teachers. On the left-hand side, it's how helpful each of the following in adopting the new standards. As you look at this, 86% said planning time to prepare the new curriculum. Time is something that surfaces all the time, if I can be redundant. I think that it's not a surprise to any of us. Enough time to really plan and develop lessons and strategies for the diverse populations that are in our classrooms. More time to collaborate with other teachers. We hear that a lot. We had that experience this summer as we did our summer leadership conference, and we had teachers together. They wanted more time to have dialogue and discussion around what strategies they're using for specific teachers, specific students. And notice on the right-hand side, it is, has your district made any of the following resources available to you? So there is that discrepancy there. And looking at what their perceptions are of what they believe is really needed and what they think they're getting in their respective school districts. Notice down the chart, talks about in-service training. 39% talked about, or the importance of in-service training. They're receiving 69% are receiving in-service training. As we probe on that, it is the type of in-service that they're receiving. One of the things that teachers have identified is, I need time and opportunity for professional learning with my colleagues within the grade level that I'm in and the content level that I'm in. That is something that the voices are increasing around that because of the depth of learning going on, but also the diversity of the students in the classrooms. And so giving enough professional learning time where I can sit with my fellow teachers, kindergarten teacher, whatever level that I'm teaching or content level that I'm teaching. So when it comes to getting Common Core implementation right, how important is each of the following? Prioritizing student learning over standardized testing comes out on top, and I don't think that's a surprise for most of us. Secondly, those financial resources make students and teachers have updated textbooks, computers, teaching and learning materials. Diverse teaching and learning materials are critical in terms of the implementation process. So as we look at, this is a brand new study coming out of Phi Delta Kappa, and Phi Delta Kappa is an educational honorary. Many of you know this particular organization. They do an annual survey of how we're doing in education across the country. Here's one on standardized tests, because that's such a critical issue for teachers. And so some teachers believe standardized tests help them with their students, others that do not. Doesn't surprise us. The question is, you know, what do we know about that? You know, is it helping? Is it not? And looking at what are the possibilities here? And I think that as we're engaging teachers, it's thinking about those standardized tests and the amount of time that it's taking away from classroom instruction and learning in the classroom. I wanted to just briefly share with you, this is brand new data. The TEL Oregon survey, TEL stands for Teaching, Empowering, Leading, and Learning. This is a new survey that Oregon administered this last spring, and it is a collaborative effort between the Oregon Education Association, the Department of Education, COSA, as well as OSBA, in terms of looking at the conditions of teaching and learning. So this is just a very small piece of this. I wanted to pull out the piece that talks about the curriculum taught in this school is aligned with Common Core standards. And so these questions are based on teachers responding for their school within their district. Notice the percentage. It says almost 80% say the curriculum taught in this school is aligned with Common Core. We have to look deeper than that, though. As you begin to delve into the data, delve into teacher perceptions, we begin to get at what do I need within my classroom to make this learning real. We can align the standards to curriculum. It's now what's the instructional strategies and practice that we need to engage in terms of helping our students learn. And notice at the bottom, class sizes are reasonable such that teachers have the time available to meeting the needs of all students. We are the lowest in the country of those states that have taken the TEL survey around teacher perceptions about class size. But thinking about that, not as a separate entity, thinking about it in relationship to implementing standards and creating positive learning environments for students. So, just in summary, what educators need to successfully implement the standards? The opportunity to provide input. We hear this loud and clear. It's that notion of bringing voice forward. And I think part of our responsibility is helping teachers understand there are a variety of ways that you can do that. So when we look at survey data, it provides us with information, but the question before us is, what do we do with that information in terms of informing any decisions that we might want to make around changes in the system? Time is there always, needing more time. And we all know that. School districts are challenged with time, enough time to educate our students. But time is certainly an important piece. Third is tools, more relevant training, what I mentioned before, high-quality examples of lesson plans, that personalized opportunity to engage my colleagues at my grade level in my content area, opportunities to observe and practice teaching the standards. This has surfaced greatly. Being able to really observe my colleagues and how they're teaching to those standards. Resources, not something that's new, but it's really important in terms of teachers as well as students having access to resources that really support the implementation of the Common Core and those specific learning targets that occur within classrooms based on those standards, and then the assessments. So one of the things that we're really focused on within the association is bringing forth those concerns, but what are the possibilities? What are some of the solutions that we need to think about and engage in? One of the things that many of you are aware of is the Oregon Education Association holds their representative assembly in the spring of each year, and that is where the association does its business and the floor debates around issues pertaining to education and education implementation that are important to the members. At this last RA, the members called for a moratorium on new high-stakes assessments. they really wanted some time to work with parents and education stakeholders to determine the appropriate use of assessments. And it's what some folks call assessment literacy, and assessment literacy for educators, but also assessment literacies for all of us, policymakers, parents, et cetera, the community members around, really what is the type of assessment that we need to be using with our students to really demonstrate that they know the information. Publicly invite Oregon legislators and elected and appointed education public officials to do the sample smarter balanced assessment. It's quite interesting. Call for congressional hearings on the misuse and abuse of standardized assessment. We know we are at a pivotal time within our country. We have been almost 15 years into No Child Left Behind, where standardized assessment was elevated to almost an end-all be-all around how we're doing in schools, how teachers are doing, and how students are doing. And finally, ask that testing programs originate from or be approved by licensed educators instead of from the for-profit testing companies. Remember, this is the membership at the assembly in the spring, and this was part of the floor debate. So, supporting and empowering educators and students in transitioning to the Common Core, we're really advocating for providing ongoing professional learning for teachers and among teachers on successful instructional practice, and focus on that instructional practice piece. It's not just on the standards, it's on the practice. Develop and sustain a connected statewide network for peer-to-peer professional learning. We're certainly looking at that in the state around a network for quality teaching and learning, and thinking about that from a regional perspective and how we can get professional learning to teachers and support them close by where they're teaching. Support educator voice in determining whether adjustments are needed at various grade levels in the implementation of the Common Core. That's something that teachers are asking for in relationship to, as I engage with these standards and develop learning targets, what's the impact on my students? I think I have some things I'd like to share about that. Continue smarter balanced field tests during the 14-15 school year while increasing professional learning support for educators. In other words, really looking at smarter balanced and studying it. What are the gaps? What have we learned from it? How did it go in terms of administration, since it's very technologically driven? Looking at it from that perspective. We don't say that, we say that very seriously, but we also understand the challenges with that as we think about our connection to the federal dollars and what comes into the state to support teaching and learning. Enact a moratorium on the use of the results of the Smarter Balanced Assessment for summative ratings of school, teacher, and administrative performance. Due to the hard work of the Department of Education and Deputy Superintendent Saxton, we've made inroads on that around. We have a request in, and it looks like it's going to be approved with the department around not using the Smarter Balanced Assessment for educator evaluation in this current year. So there's a step forward with that. And then finally, determine the appropriate role of summative assessment in the Oregon education system. And this is a piece that we're very excited about. Dr. Nancy Golden approached our president, Hannah Vandereen, and at OEA, and said, let's pull a group of teachers together. Let's start with the voices of the practitioners to begin to think deeply about what could be an appropriate assessment system. What is the role of that summative assessment within our assessment system? And so we have pulled together a group of 16 teachers, and they are engaged in talking about what are the possibilities in terms of an assessment system that would really help enhance student learning, not just verify or certify whether a student has learned in terms of a summative assessment. And so in partnership with Rob Saxton at the Department of Education, we are engaged in that work. I'm pleased to say that Jenna Miller is one of those individuals sitting on that work group. And it is not just isolating teachers to determine this, but it's now getting to a point of reaching out to our education partners and say, join us us in this deep thinking about what's the possibility here. And so, but we wanted to initially give teachers a voice so that they could come together and think about the possibilities. So with that, I want to introduce again Jenna Miller, who's going to talk a little bit about her work on the work group as well as her own teaching experience.
Ms. Chair, before we go to Jenna, if I could, number one, I think the more centralized education becomes, the worse the outcomes are, and I think that's relatively clear over the last few decades. I just want to make a point on your chart where what teachers like about Common Core helps students develop critical thinking and problem-solving skills. I just wanted to suggest that that was already going on, and that's one of the core things that teachers do anyway, so that's not an add to anything.
Thank you.
All right. Good morning. I'm Jenna Miller, and I am an ELD specialist in North Clackamas School District in the middle school. So an ELD is English Language Development, just because they like to change the name of my job a lot. So I was asked, I think it was last spring, to be part of this assessment work group. And to be honest, I wasn't quite sure what I was getting myself into when I first showed up at the meeting. But it has been a really great experience, and it's been an honor to work as part of this group. There are teachers all over the state, and there are people in the governor's office and the OEIB, and it's really just been a very collaborative process where I feel like each of us has an equal voice at the table to share our concerns. And we started out the process at our very first meeting talking about our dreams and hopes and also our fears for this process. We've had several meetings, and out of those meetings, we've really come up with kind of a philosophy or what we want a model system of assessment to look like. And I think, to me, the biggest thing we want is a system of assessments that focuses on student growth, and not just student growth that they met a certain point or a certain level, but that we take students where they start at and we show their growth on a continuum. We also want student ownership of their learning and of the assessment process. So when a student takes an assessment, they should be able to know from the results what they need to do to improve their own learning. We want an assessment system that drives instruction and it preserves student learning time. So the next steps of this process, even though it seems like we've done a lot of work, we still have a lot of work ahead of us. We have this philosophy, and now we're meeting next week, and we need to kind of, I think, look at types of assessment and use our philosophy as kind of a lens to see what types of assessments really meet that philosophy. So even though it seems like we've made a lot of progress, there's still a lot of work to do. One of the reasons why I think I'm here today and part of that assessment is I see myself as an advocate for my students and also for teachers that I work with. And my hopes around assessment kind of revolve around those two things. First, with my students, I really want them to see the growth they've made and to value that. Last year, I taught a reading intervention class that was primarily dual-identified students. So they were special education students and English language learners. And I saw them two periods a day, and we worked really hard all year. And they, I think, felt that they were making growth. But when it came time to take the OAKS assessment, I tried really hard to pump them up. I showed them where they were the year before, and I said, this is typical growth, and this is where my goal for you to make is. And we took the OAKS, and every student showed growth, and many students blew their typical growth out of the water. But the first thing most of them said to me was, did I pass? And then when you had to tell them, you didn't pass, but look at this growth you've made. You could see it in their body language that they just really wanted to pass. So that's one of my hopes, is that we can develop a system of assessments that really celebrates that growth that students are making. I also want an assessment that doesn't take away from valuable instruction time. When you have an assessment and it says, this takes 2 days, for a student to complete. For my students I work with, that 2 days is usually 5 days or longer, because they just take a little bit longer to get through the reading passages and to do their very best. That's the amount of time they need. And that's valuable instruction time that they are losing every year. As far as teachers go, I want an assessment that gives me information that I can take back the very next day to my classroom and impact student learning. I want it to tell me exactly what my students need and exactly what I can do to help them improve. We also see a lot of students, or a lot of teachers in our building, that are have new standards, and they're having to come up with new curriculum to teach those standards.
I apologize, but we need to wrap up.
Okay. And so it's just really hard for them to be coming up with new standards, but then also learning how to find ways to differentiate for all students with the new curriculum.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for opening this discussion. Rob Saxton is here, I believe, the deputy superintendent. If you could come in and move this discussion further or weigh in. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining
us
today.
Members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent for Oregon, and it's good to be here this morning, first time in for these days, and as we warm up into the upcoming session. So I thought this morning I might, at your pleasure, make a few comments about what's been shared here, and then also obviously be available for any kinds of questions you might like to ask. So just a few things. First of all, I just want to say how much I appreciate the work that OEA has done to query their members and find out where they are and what, you know, sort of what they're thinking about, how they're feeling about the support that they've received thus far in implementing a couple really significant changes and things that I think are very important for us to get right. I mean, right now with the Common Core standards, what we're really attempting to do is make sure that students who move through our school system are ready for their next steps. And that is a very important, obviously, thing for us to accomplish, and that we need to make sure that we have a set of standards that are aligned from the time the child arrives in school to the time that they exit the 12th grade to make sure whatever it is that they hope to do or be, that they've got the knowledge and the skills so that they're ready to be whatever it is that they hope to be in their next steps. That's a really important consideration. It's a difficult and big piece of work, especially because the knowledge set and the expectation that exists is different than it used to be. It's the amount of knowledge that's come into the world or is available to be accessed in the world has increased exponentially. And for students to be able to, or people to be prepared to be successful in that world, it means that there's a great deal of knowledge and information that needs to be mastered. The set of standards that we have adopted, the Common Core State Standards, were adopted by the State Board in 2010. I think they're a really high-quality set of standards. They're probably as good or better than any standards that Oregon has previously adopted when it comes to English language arts and math, and really setting out specific expectations from grade to grade about what the learning progression would look like and the knowledge and skill progression would look like, so that by the time children do graduate from high school, that they're much more likely to be successful in their next steps. I know that you all have heard often about the amount of developmental education that takes place in our colleges. And if we think about the old standards that we have, I have to think that they contributed to the amount of developmental education that we've been required to give our students once they matriculate onto college. And so I believe that these standards will help reduce that requirement. I appreciate very much the presentation about the need to hear teacher voice, and I think that we're working really hard to cause that to happen in the state. Certainly the TEL survey that we gave last year, with significant participation on the part of teachers across the state, that give us some feedback about what they're learning, what their teaching conditions are like, what supports they need, and what teaching is like in the state has been very valuable. I was pleased and a little bit surprised to see that 79.9% of teachers said that their curriculum aligns to the Common Core. 1 year before we're going to implement the assessment for the first time, which would happen this spring. So that was a nice result for us to see. Certainly, there are lots more work that we need to do in order to get this done. The we did secure some resources from the legislature out of the last legislative session, approximately $11 million, to work on both the evaluation model that we now have and implementation of the Common Core. And with those dollars, we were able to provide 6 days of workshops for representatives of every school district in the state, where we came in and we worked through the Common Core did a train-the-trainer model, where we gave training about the Common Core so that that team could then go back to their district and provide training to teachers. And then we also took some of that resource and funneled it out to school districts across the state so that they had resource then to help the teachers participate in that training, which has been good. Also have wanted to take a look at other kinds of supports that we give around training. Currently in the state, we receive $21 million each year from the federal government in Title IIA funds. And Title IIA funds can be used for only one thing, training. If you don't use them for training, we have to send them back. And so people typically use those $21 million to $42 million a biennium around training. And so I hope that districts, because those dollars are sent on to districts, I hope that districts, and I do believe from having spoken to a number of districts, that they're working hard to with teachers around the training that it's going to take for them to be where they need to be around the Common Core state standards. The last thing I would talk about is assessment. And I think that we have a tendency too often to get these two things mixed together, the Common Core state standards and the assessment. Once we've adopted a new set of standards, to keep the same assessment that we've had that is going to measure student knowledge against a different set of standards, the old Oregon standards, which is what the Oaks did, is not appropriate. And in fact, since 2010, we've had this, we want to be teaching to the Common Core state standards, and an assessment that doesn't necessarily measure to those standards, and so we've had a miss. The first time that we'll have an assessment that actually aligns to these new standards is this spring. I do absolutely agree with what was asserted here earlier today that we have an overemphasis on the summative assessment. We do. I would also, however, admit that whenever we talk about student results in the state of Oregon, almost universally, besides perhaps graduation and attendance rates, we talk about student outcomes in terms of did they or did they not pass the current summative assessment, the Oaks. What percent of students were reading at third grade? We base that on the Oaks. What percent of students were meeting math? We base it on the Oaks. What percent of students met the benchmark in 11th grade? We base it on the Oaks. And all of us do it. And in many ways, it gives weight and strength to this summative assessment. The truth is, the best kind of assessment to help students learn happens in the classroom on a daily basis. In education, we call it either interim or formative. I'll talk about formative assessment. Formative assessment happens nearly on a daily basis, where a teacher has a quick assessment that they can give to students. It may just be what did you get for the answer on this particular question, and a quick check around the classroom to know, or if you're technology enhanced, that you could look on your iPad and know what percent of the students got the answer right to a question that you asked, to figure out have students mastered what's been taught, and if they have, then we can move on, and if they haven't, then we need to circle back. And it's a feedback loop about instruction and about learning. And being really good with formative assessment is what truly enhances student learning on a daily basis. And I love that we've entered into this work that Colleen talked about, where we've got teachers and myself and Nancy from OEIB and staff from there working together to think about what does a really good comprehensive but reasonable assessment system look like in the state of Oregon. How do we make sure that we get that right so that we're not taking too much time, so that the assessments that are given, either formative or interim in the classroom, are really high quality and give teachers the feedback that they want, and that we make sure that students who are struggling, we're able to identify and give them the supports they need. And at the end of the day, that there is an assessment that's given, and it will be this spring, the Smarter Balance Assessment, that gives us a snapshot in time about how well students performed in aggregate in our state so that we can be informed about things that we need to do, and that there is at least some measure of accountability about outcomes for students. So that's where I would hope that we would get. I'm really pleased that we're moving from an assessment system that used to allow students to take the summative assessment three times every school year, to an assessment system that's going to allow that assessment to be taken just once. We needed to do that some years ago. We've spent too much time letting students take summative assessment and not giving them instruction. The one-time assessment is a significant improvement. So I just wanted to touch base on those things. We have virtually, not like in paper, in writing yet, but virtually secured an agreement from the U.S. Department of Ed that will not need to use results from the summative assessment and teacher evaluation in at least the first year. We continue to not have completely secured our waiver with USED because we push on them on this item all the time. It is the sticking point for us sort of receiving our waiver as opposed to being conditional or at high risk, as they call us. Double secret probation, we call it at the department. But we're going to continue to push on that. We think that if we're going to use any kind of summative measure and evaluation, that it's got to be done really appropriately. We work closely with OEA, Chalkboard, COSA, OEIB, and the development of the evaluation model that we forwarded back to the department that we believe that eventually they will approve, and we feel good about that work, and that we need to be really thoughtful about how we use any kind of summative assessment and educator evaluation. So I'll stop there. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Rowland.
The only concern I have about the one test is that it makes it more of a high-stake test than it's ever been before. I mean, kids don't get a chance, and it makes it much, much more difficult. The other question that I would ask about that is that as they develop the summative test, are they developing it on the old bell curve so that they keep moving the middle of the curve up as kids start approaching getting better at it? I mean, I really worry that we are looking at the right things because, as I've always told teachers, if you have a test and you keep giving it over and you keep wanting to find a bell curve, it just means that you're isolating for kids' intelligence, not for what they know. And if you don't smooth the curve, then you didn't teach anything. And if they keep changing the center of that curve, it doesn't let us know if we're really actually doing what our teacher said before, and that is getting kids to understand stuff. So do you know how they're designing it? Because it really frustrates me when I watch us switch tests and re-normalize wherever the curves are.
Chair Haas, Senator Rowland, this assessment is being is a standards assessment, so it is about meeting or not meeting, basically. So there's a set of standards and not a variable curve that's set within it. It'll be nationally norm referenced. Something that will be different is for the first time, multiple states, there'll be about 19 states that use this assessment, and there'll be some comparison between states in a different way than what we've probably been able to do before. But it is absolutely set. It's set at what they're determining or calling the NAEP, the National Assessment of Education Progress, is the typical test that we talk about as far as how national assessment students are doing in learning across the nation. It will be at the NAEP proficient level. So NAEP has had a proficient level for a long time, has held steady, and so I don't anticipate that they'll be shifting that around. Now, getting the test right the first year to the second year, there could be some small fluctuation, and that'll be about getting it at the NAEP proficient standard, making sure that it's set there appropriately. As far as high stakes is concerned, it is a high stakes assessment. I worry most about the high stakes component of the student, and the place where it's high stakes for the student in particular is in the 11th grade, because with the Oregon diploma, you have to demonstrate a set of essential skills in math, in writing, and in English language arts or reading. And one way to demonstrate that you're proficient is by passing the test at a certain level. That level will remain, the old Oaks test and the new Smarter Balance test level for meeting the essential skills will remain consistent. We don't expect there'll be any fewer students who meet on this test than did on the previous test, except for the fact that students will be able to take it once, which will probably diminish that a little bit. One nice thing about Oregon, which is slightly unusual as compared to other states, is there are multiple ways that students can demonstrate that they've met the essential skill. They can do it with this test, but they can also do it with a series of other tests, SAT, ACT, work keys, and work sample in the classroom. So there, we want to make sure that students have multiple opportunities to pass the essential skills in 11th grade and earn an Oregon diploma.
And thank you.
Real quick.
Yeah.
I almost got to take the test last time, the practice test. I anticipate taking them here shortly. And I guess my concern in talking to some of the people who have taken the practice test is that it's like a lot of other standardized tests. It seems to be a more of a gotcha test than it does a test of skills and knowledge, so that you end up with tests that have multiple answers that are so close to each other. You prevent guessing, but it also creates a whole bunch of answers that I could make a case for are all right or all wrong, and when. So many of the times, if you really want to do formative assessment, if you really want to get at what kids know, you want to make sure that they're, as they work towards an answer. And I find this more in English. I was a math guy. I liked that much so much better because I could work out a problem and it was there or it wasn't there. The English people, and we're going to hear from dyslexic, and I am dyslexic, it was much, much more complicated. But it is very frustrating for kids when they look like two or three answers that are so much alike. We're not trying to get at their answer. We're trying to get at whether they can make the nuanced difference between why one is better than another. I worry about that, and I haven't taken the test, so I can't personally say that. I've just talked to people who have had that problem. Any?
Chair Haas, Senator Rowland, ex-math teacher myself, so mea culpa on that for sure. I always worried, especially on a multiple choice component of a test, that it's so easy to have a gotcha because you can set up multiple choice that's kind of tricky, and I used to snicker about a few of the questions that I put together and then try to be thoughtful about how to grade those, right? But one of the good things about this assessment is it is much less multiple choice than our old one was 100% multiple choice. This one will have some multiple choice, some extended response, and some full-on work sample that's built right into the assessment, and they will be human scored. And so we'll have somebody actually sit down and look at this and try to make sense out of what kind of response was given, and there can be credit along the way for the kind of work that gets done as opposed to yes, no.
Thank you. Thank you for this presentation. We'll have more to go on this when we have more time in the months ahead. So
wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Saxon. Speaking of dyslexia, I want to bring up our team of dyslexia experts here and very committed parents who are looking at possible changes to the way we educate children with dyslexia. Welcome. We saved the best for last. Sorry, I don't mean to rush you here, but we
talk fast.
Okay.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Lyon, for the record. I want to just introduce the other members of the team. Jen Capalanga is a parent and an educator. Moira Finnegan is a speech-language pathologist. And Alicia Roberts-Franks is a professor of special ed at Lewis and Clark. Also in attendance is Emery Roberts, the youngest member of our team. She's a high school student right here from Lincoln High School. She has submitted a letter, which you will be receiving. She is also the founder of the Dyslexia Student Union at Lincoln High School. My son Theo attends fifth grade at a Portland Public School. We are a fortunate family. A private psychologist identified my son with dyslexia in second grade and recommended he receive private tutoring three times a week. So that is what we have done. Unfortunately, many students with the same learning profile as my son are not getting the recommended evidence-based instruction that they need to learn to read. I am here on behalf of Decoding Dyslexia Oregon. We are a group of parents and educators concerned by the lack of evidence-based instruction for children with dyslexia and related language-based learning differences in the public schools. We are advocating for improved teacher training and delivery of evidence-based instruction for general education as well as for special education teachers. Decoding Dyslexia Oregon is part of a national movement, one of 47 chapters throughout the U.S. Parents and educators have rapidly bonded over social media, and our stories are more similar than different. We are keenly aware of progress being made in other states, and we are inspired by changes happening across the country. New laws, pilot programs, comprehensive teacher training programs, and successful classroom instruction. Decoding Dyslexia holds monthly meetings for parents and educators. At our first meeting of the year last week, 80 people attended. One couple drove 211 miles from Pendleton, Oregon. While this type of interest in our program fuels us, it also makes us question, why are neither the state nor the schools providing quality information for which its citizens are clamoring? To meet Oregon's goal of having all children reading at grade level by the end of third grade, we believe it is essential to provide appropriate teacher training and explicit instruction for the 15 to 20% of students with this neurological brain difference. We challenge the state to offer meaningful professional development and services and to improve standards for incoming teachers. The good news is there are plenty of programs that provide results for struggling readers. They're explicit, direct instruction, multisensory, and systematic. The even better news is these programs work for English language learners as well. The bad news is Oregon's teachers, through no fault of their own, are ill-prepared to instruct children with this learning difference. Currently, you cannot take a course in dyslexia in the state of Oregon. Even teachers who have earned their master's degrees in reading or in special education are not educated about dyslexia. Ask any teacher you know what he or she knows about dyslexia, and their response will be informative. Oregon's teachers need more tools in their toolbox. Despite the failures of the past, I am hopeful as I come before you today on behalf of a grandmother who is struggling to find services for her grandson. She shared that her father never learned to read and that she fought with the school system to provide appropriate instruction for her son 25 years ago. She never dreamt the public schools would fail three generations of her family. There is a strong genetic component to dyslexia that I believe has prevented many illiterate parents from successfully advocating for their children. The last place to which an illiterate person wants to return is the principal's office. October is Dyslexia Awareness Month, and Decoding Dyslexia would like to work with the Senate by providing a Dyslexia 101 training or dyslexia simulation to begin increasing awareness of this invisible and frequently misunderstood learning difference. I know that addressing these fundamental issues would be a win-win for legislators, principals, teachers, families, and students like my son. When these issues are addressed, then everyone will win. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Capalonga, and I am from Portland. I hope to shed light on a little-known and hidden educational equity issue in our state. I'll do so by sharing the story of my son, Garrett. The beginning of Garrett's story is the same as thousands of children in Oregon's public schools. Garrett was distressed in first grade when, despite his tremendous effort, he was not learning to read. I, as his mother, practiced and practiced with him, but he struggled. I'm also a trained special education teacher with a master's in education, so I used all of my training to help him. But he continued to make minimal progress. There began to be talk among the teachers at his school that the standards were too high for children like Garrett. I was terrified for my son. The part where Garrett's story begins to differ for thousands of children in Oregon is when at age 7, he was diagnosed by a private educational psychologist as moderately dyslexic. Garrett's educational psychologist recommended that the best practice for someone with dyslexia was Orton-Gillingham tutoring. Since Garrett's public school did not offer this type of evidence-based instruction, we resorted to private tutoring for Garrett. Garrett has received tutoring twice a week for 2 years. Because this type of instruction matches his neuroanatomy, he has thrived. Today, he has learned the tools he needs to succeed in the classroom. He is happy and confident, and has even exceeded the standards in both reading and math on the OAKS exams. I come before you to say that not providing these evidence-based instruction to Oregon students is an equity issue. Many parents who have concerns about the current state of education for dyslexic children in Oregon do not have the luxury of speaking before you today, nor the ability to pay $5,000 to $8,000 a year for private tutoring when instruction is not provided in the schools. As a teacher, I couldn't understand why so many of my bright, capable students with learning disabilities were so unengaged in their education, as evidenced by their poor attendance and poor assignment completion rates. Today, as a parent, having seen all that students with dyslexia endure, I am surprised that they continue to attend school at all. I want you to know that the story of Oregon students with dyslexia is not hopeless. There are scientifically proven methodology to provide our children with the free and appropriate education that they are entitled to. These methods can be taught in cost-effective ways to all students. On behalf of Oregon's children, I implore you to seriously examine this issue, to consult with qualified experts, and formulate a plan which will bring these methods to Oregon schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Moira Finnegan, and I'm a speech-language pathologist with Portland Public Schools. I'd like to tell you a story of how I became passionate about addressing the needs of students with dyslexia. My first year on the job, I had a fifth-grade student who transferred to my school from a special school for children with the most challenging behavior problems. At my first meeting with him, this student said to me, "Can I tell you a secret?" And I said, "Nope, I just met you. You can tell me your secret next time." It turns out his secret was, "I can't read." He was a fifth grader, but he was reading and writing at the kindergarten level. He had behavior issues, which may well have developed as a way to divert attention from the fact that he couldn't read. But he had shown the courage to tell his secret in the hopes that someone would finally teach him how to read. I was shocked and perplexed as to how this student had made it all the way from kindergarten to fifth grade, and yet no one had ever taught him how to read. I said to this student, "This is your lucky year. I'm going to teach you how to read." But I quickly realized I was in way over my head. This student could read simple words like top, but when I added an S to create the word stop, he was completely confused and could not read it. When I worked with this student, my stomach would be in knots because I knew I didn't have the skills to help him. I could not understand why he seemed unable to learn how to read, but I had a suspicion that he may have dyslexia. I sought out specialized training on dyslexia, and my suspicions were confirmed. This student was suffering from severe dyslexia that had remained undiagnosed and untreated all these years. How was it possible that not a single educator among all those who had worked with this student over the years had missed the clear signs of dyslexia? I came to realize that there is a gaping hole in knowledge and services within our school system regarding dyslexia, and thousands of kids like this student are suffering because of it. This lack of knowledge is by no means unique to Portland Public Schools. Indeed, this gap in knowledge exists in school districts throughout Oregon and across the country. Educators need to know what works for students with dyslexia. Children with dyslexia respond best to sequenced, systematic, and explicit reading instruction that involves several senses, hearing, seeing, and touch, at the same time. When given this type of instruction, students with dyslexia can learn to read. I only wish I had had the opportunity to use this teaching method with my student. Unfortunately, he moved to another state, so I never got the chance to try these methods with him. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, children identified as reading disabled after second grade rarely catch up to their peers. We know that third grade students who are not reading at grade level are four times less likely to earn a high school diploma. For students living in poverty, reading below grade level in third grade makes them 12 times less likely to graduate from high school. So we have to reach these kids by first grade in order to give them the best chance of graduating from high school, which will in turn give them the best chances of succeeding in life. I want to say in the strongest possible terms that dyslexia is an equity issue. Parents of the students I work with in North Portland will never be able to afford the private evaluations or tutoring that Jen and Lisa were able to provide for their children. Many families trust that the public school system will do right by their children, that educators have the necessary knowledge and skills to teach all children how to read. In reality, we educators are not given the tools we need in our teacher preparation programs to recognize and treat dyslexia in our students. The unfortunate result is thousands of students like my fifth grader who could not read and perhaps never will. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee.
My name is Alicia Roberts Frank, and I am the Special Education Director and in the Teacher Education Department at Lewis and Clark College, where I also teach future elementary and secondary teachers. I joined Decoding Dyslexia because every child deserves to learn to read. Every child deserves a free public education, which many students with dyslexia are not receiving. I began my teaching career in California at a private elementary school for children with dyslexia, where I was trained in Slingerland, a classroom adaptation of the Orton-Gillingham approach, both of which are evidence-based approaches to teaching students with dyslexia. The training I went through opened my eyes to the many ways students can struggle when learning to read, as well as the efficacy of using a multisensory approach for building neurological connections. It's one thing to read about the changes that can happen in the brain as a result of instruction, but another to see a child make a cognitive connection as a result of a physical action. That knowledge base that I gained helped me recognize students who were misidentified for special education and those whose educational programs were inappropriate. And it enabled me to reach all learners and help them unlock print. Since becoming a teacher trainer, I've encountered numerous educators like Moira and Jen, teachers who, because they care deeply about their students' success, are desperately seeking for increased knowledge and skills so that they can reach their struggling learners. I joined Decoding Dyslexia because I have seen firsthand the struggles, frustration, and pain individuals with dyslexia can experience when they are not taught decoding strategies, as well as the pride and joy they experience when they discover that they can read, they can unlock meaning from print. I have seen numerous teachers and teacher candidates relieved, as I was, to learn that our language isn't a mystery, that the connection between speech and print really does make sense. Research has shown that approximately 60% of children learning to read find learning to read a challenge, and that for at least 20 to 30% of them, learning to read is one of the most difficult tasks they will ever undertake. Many of these children have dyslexia, yet none of the standards for training teachers in Oregon include the ability to recognize dyslexia or teach explicit decoding skills. The consequences of not adequately educating students with dyslexia are incredibly costly. The high incarceration rates of illiterate individuals, the cost of remedial programs, and the loss in human capital are just a few examples of how this educational oversight damages Oregon's economy. We also know that without addressing the educational needs of students with dyslexia, Oregon will not come close to meeting the governor's 40-40-20 goals. We strongly urge you to invest in preventative care for Oregon students. Our proposal is to craft legislation that ensures training for all of Oregon's teachers on indicators of dyslexia and evidence-based teaching techniques for students with dyslexia. Dyslexia screening for all students in Oregon, and early intervention for all students with dyslexia. Our hope is that we can begin the teacher training piece in the upcoming legislative session by simply requiring that each school district address the characteristics of students with dyslexia and their academic and emotional needs as part of professional development. We know that this investment will have huge rewards for Oregon's students, families, teachers, and economy. Thank you for your time today, and we are happy to answer any questions.
I appreciate all of your work, and especially those of you parents who have struggled with children with dyslexia, and we only have a moment left here, and I just look forward to the legislation that we have in the coming sessions.
I was just going to say, and having had every male in my family is dyslexic, so and having a brother that was severely dyslexic, I wasn't as much. He came to live with much younger than I came to live with my wife and I when we were in college, and went to Renton, Washington, which had a whole separate school developed for Gillingham teaching. So Gillingham is just brand new, right?
It's been around a long time.
I mean, the thing that's so frustrating is to realize how long it has been and how successful it has been. Though I would say that having done it in a school which all the kids were dyslexic was much better, because I will tell you that for most of those kids, the difficulty of writing on a person's back or on the table or whatever would not go well in a regular classroom. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how you do that without having a group of them, because the interaction with kids can sometimes... Our family is not only dyslexic, we're also ADHD. So it makes it much more difficult to concentrate on any of that stuff in the first place. So How do we get people the knowledge, enough knowledge? Because I don't think that just training it, you can identify, but how do you get the people who have the skills to actually teach that in public schools? I guess that's my question.
The standards. Yep. I have heard when you say that how you get that happening, and I've heard of classrooms even at the high school level where the teacher will initially cover up the window so that the kids walking by don't see the air writing.
Right.
But then the kids later on say, take
it's
it down, we don't care.
Okay.
Because
that's
we
good
know
to hear.
That this is helping and this is really working for us. And one of the things that we're advocating is at least for the teachers to recognize that there's a red flag here. We need to talk about this. And if we had one person at the school who could teach those small groups, to teach those kids okay. how in the multisensory approaches, that was what would be powerful.
Okay. That's good to hear.
I don't think that's unreasonable either.
I agree. No, it's definitely not unreasonable.
Thank you. We're going to continue this. Committee, thank you. We'll have drafts of these committee bills before the December hearing.
It absolutely does.
So, thank you all. No further business before us. We are adjourned.
But I keep going.